Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the tonight's screening of No Job for a Woman, a documentary about female World War II correspondents. I'm Nan Heehan, a correspondent governor of the FCC, but before I begin, can everyone turn off their mobile phones or switch them off to silent, please? Thank you. At this day and age, it's hard to believe that women were once barred from covering the front lines of the battlefield, but that was the case in the 1930s and 40s. I'm sure many of you were not aware, myself included, of all the restrictions and struggles that female journalists had to go through to cover World War II. So this film we're about to see is an important reminder of how far we've come in gender and journalism today, thanks to these remarkable women who broke through those barriers to report the biggest historical event at that time. Their careers had an innumerable impact. They helped other women break into the field, a liberty we appreciate today when female war reporters are no longer a novelty concept. We are very honored to have one of the first female war correspondents here with us tonight, Claire Hollingworth. As many of you already know, Claire is a doyenne in World War II coverage. She's also an FCC ambassador. Having covered many conflict zones around the world, she's one of the most recognizable faces in war reporting. The legendary anecdote about Claire that continues to be retold at the main bar is how she was the first journalist to break the news that Germany was about to invade Poland. By the way, we're almost approaching the 75th anniversary of that event. Claire persuaded the British consul at the time to lend her a car. She drove to the German-Polish border, only to witness Nazi troops and tanks approaching Poland. Initially, few people believed her account, but her newspaper did. The Daily Telegraph published the news before every other media news organization. That's one of many contributions from Claire. Thanks for joining us today. We have another special guest here tonight, filmmaker Michelle Midori-Filion. Michelle is a radio and TV journalist who produced many short documentaries in the past with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. No Job for a Woman is her first full-length documentary feature, which chronicled a very perplexing time in gender and journalism. A few words from the filmmaker before we watch the film. Everyone, please give a warm welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here tonight. It's a real pleasure, and thank you to Karsten for actually reaching out to me. And the stars aligned. My older daughter has been working in Hong Kong for the past couple of months, and the timing worked out perfectly. So I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm sure a lot of you know the women that are in this film, but most people haven't, including myself. So almost 20 years ago, when I was in journalism school, I first read a book called Women of the World, The Great Foreign Correspondents by Julia Edwards, who was herself a foreign correspondent. And I was mesmerized by the book and couldn't believe that I hadn't heard of most of the women, and actually vowed from that point that I would do a documentary about these women, for whom I have just endless admiration, and I would have loved for this to have been a multi-part series, because there were 140 women that were accredited during World War II to the American Army. And this is the story of three of them. I hope you have a lot of questions afterwards, and I look forward to them. Thank you.
Okay. Major funding for this program has been provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Exploring the human endeavor.
Today, it's commonplace for women to report war. Before World War II, women were just shut out for the most part. But you always had a few brave and resolute souls who wanted to go forth and cover war, just like men.
During World War II, the United States government accredited nearly 140 women war correspondents. But there was a catch. 1943. Wire Service reporter Ruth Cowan, 42 years old. After years of dutifully reporting stories destined for the women's pages, she became the first woman reporter to be accredited to the U.S. Army. Cowan wanted to bear witness to history in the making. In North Africa, where women correspondents were barred from using Army jeeps, Cowan was almost killed hitching a ride during an Army retreat. 1944. Magazine reporter Martha Gellhorn, 36 years old. An experienced war correspondent and acclaimed author, she believed exposing the horrors of war could change the course of history. Gellhorn was one of the only reporters, male or female, to make it ashore during the D-Day invasion, where women reporters were officially banned. She was arrested and stripped of her credentials. 1945. Photographer Dickie Chappelle, 25 years old. Young and adventurous, Chappelle was determined to report the story of war from the front line. Restricted to an assignment aboard a hospital ship in the Pacific, Chappelle talked her way onto Okinawa, attempting to photograph action at the front. She was taken into custody and sent home in disgrace.
War was man's territory. So the idea of a woman breaking into the male turf was unheard of. In fact, it just sort of shocked people.
Women choosing to be in the middle of violent confrontation that involves mud and weaponry and blood, that's not where women are supposed to be.
The restrictions on women reporters forced them to look elsewhere for the story of war.
In the process of doing it, they created a new war story. It was not just a battlefield story and men telling the story. They changed the notion of what the war story could be and what, in fact, it was.
For the war correspondents of World War II, the gender gap was so much bigger than it is for us. And they were fighting such a bigger battle than we are. It was a different time for them, the women of World War II.
In 1929, reporter Baldwin Cowan was having a good reporting year in San Antonio, Texas. Cowan wired in stories about local politics to the offices of the United Press.
The UP thought, boy, this young guy is great. He's really prolific. Well, then the UP executive went to the state's political convention, and there was Baldwin Cowan, this blonde young woman, fired her on the spot just because she was female, even though she was doing a great job.
Baldwin Cowan was Ruth Baldwin Cowan, a 28-year-old reporter. Orphaned from the age of 12, she had learned to fight for herself. Undaunted by being fired, she wrote a letter to their competition, the Associated Press.
First of all, I'm a girl. I snore at women's luncheons. But I have no objections to exploiting the women's angle in any field. But I like murders, politics, gang wars, and plenty of action.
Immediately hired by the Associated Press in Chicago, Cowan thought her assignment would be local politics. But because she was a woman, she was given a different assignment.
Women find it difficult to compete with men in general reporting jobs. So girls who want to be successful in journalism should prepare for work in the special women's department.
Most women who were in journalism work for women's sections. The women's pages were not considered places for serious reporting. They were considered places for sort of fluffy, inconsequential stuff. What you might call the four F's: fashion, food, furniture, and family. Ruth Cowan covered the kinds of stories that were assigned to women reporters.
Here's an idea that will give a new lease on life to those plain black silk crepe or solid wool frocks that seem weary from a long winter's wear. A huge organdy bow measuring a foot.
She realized that was her meal ticket, that was her bread and butter, but she also realized that was only a part of the story, and in some ways it could be a demeaning part of the story. And she has trouble with that. She struggles with that.
Cowan made repeated requests to be transferred to Washington, where she thought she would have access to more serious stories. In 1940, her persistence paid off. December 7th, 1941, was a quiet Sunday afternoon at the Washington Bureau of the Associated Press.
Sunday mornings in newsrooms are typically dead time, and so there'd be almost no reporters or editors in a wire service or radio newsroom. There might be one person there, probably just to make sure that the world didn't blow up.
Ruth Cowan was covering a luncheon for the wife of a visiting ambassador when the biggest story of the century broke.
When a switchboard operator calls a newsroom to say stand by for the press secretary for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you know something monumental, especially on a Sunday morning, is about to happen.
From the offices of the AP, news went out over the wire to newsrooms across the country.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air. President Roosevelt has just announced.
Among the Americans transfixed by the news coming out of their radio was aspiring photographer and aviation enthusiast, Dickie Chappelle. She was living in New York City when she heard the news.
She was, of course, horrified, as all Americans were, and she wanted to do something about it. She wanted to help.
Adventurous and ambitious, Chappelle began contacting editors with story ideas to jumpstart her news photography career. Veteran war reporter Martha Gellhorn and her husband, novelist and journalist Ernest Hemingway, were on vacation.
We were drinking daiquiris in a mingy little bar on the Mexican border. A tattered child came in with some newspapers and said, "La guerra, la guerra." Smeary type announced Pearl Harbor and America's declaration of war.
Martha's immediate reaction was, as it always would be, "I must get out there and start covering it and do something." His reaction was, "Let's settle down and sit this out and do nothing." And really, on that day, in a sense, was born what I think would bring their marriage to an end.
Back in Washington, on the night of the Pearl Harbor attacks, Ruth Cowan headed over to the National Press Club, along with all the other reporters. The club, like the field of journalism itself, was segregated. Cowan and her female colleagues were only allowed in the ladies' dining room.
There was a tenseness in the air, as throughout all America. I listened to the shop talk. This war is going to last longer than people think. Suddenly, covering the women's angle in Washington for the AP became to me not enough. I leaned forward to the girl with whom I dined. "Let's go to war. Why can't we be women war correspondents?"
To fight such a major world war, that means that women as mothers and wives and sisters and girlfriends had to be persuaded that it was their war too. And so the government had a very deliberate, thought-out plan, complete with media support, to persuade thousands of women to take factory jobs to support the war.
That became Cowan's next assignment, Not reporting on the war, reporting on the mobilization of women.
What about the farm wife? The housewives in large cities and at cross corners? The homebodies? The older women? What are they doing to help win the war? Plenty.
Cowan is really dying to get involved in war coverage, to be actually where the action is, like any good reporter. She asks her boss several times to send her to the London Bureau. There's no women over there for the AP at the time. And they say, no, it's, you know, the war is not the woman's angle. It's not your job. It's a man's story.
While the woman's story was becoming tiresome for Cowan, a younger reporter was happily reporting the new roles for women. Dickie Chappelle was just 22 years old and had been passionate about aviation since her childhood in Milwaukee, when aviation pioneer Admiral Richard Byrd, Dickie Byrd, attempted the first flight over the North Pole.
Aviation in her childhood is what computers became in another age to young people. Aviation was the new frontier, and Dickie wanted to be at that frontier.
Born Georgette Louise, she was so intrigued by Byrd that she changed her name to Dickie. When her poor eyesight prevented her from becoming a pilot herself, she hitched rides on planes and reported about the experience.
We go up to 10,000 feet. I want to yell, "This is it! Now we'll find out if a girl can dive 7 miles a minute and live." I hold my breath. The engine roars, going 70 miles an hour. Maybe I have traveled faster than any other woman.
She was taken with the idea of defying gravity. And in some ways, all of Dickie's life was about defying gravity and defying tradition.
And defying barriers. At age 16, she was one of the first women to go to MIT. But engineering held none of the allure of flying. She studied photography, married her photography teacher, and became one of the first women news photographers using her aviation knowledge to sell stories to editors.
As the war progressed, the government realized that they would have to use more and more women, not just in the civilian labor force, but also as members of the uniformed military, because it takes a lot of administering to wage a war. You know, you can't fight a war without secretaries. You can't fight a war without communication specialists, code breakers, signal corps operatives, and without nurses.
For Cowan, everything changes with the creation of the WACS, a Women's Auxiliary Corps. These are actually women who, for the first time, would be in the military. And that's one reason it's so important for women journalists, is because all of a sudden the AP decides, these are women soldiers. We need a woman to report on it.
The deployment of the Women's Army Corps gave Cowan her break. Following the WACS overseas, finally, she was a war reporter. But another woman would get all of the fanfare.
Life magazine described Margaret Burke White as America's first girl war reporter. Of course she wasn't, but it was part of Life's marketing of its own person. Life magazine was practically an arm of the U.S. government. Their contribution in terms of woman power was to have Margaret Burke White, who was one of the most celebrated journalists of the World War II era. She was the model for the uniform that was designed for women correspondents.
It all comes together for Dickie Chappelle when she sees Margaret Burke White. War intrigues Dickie, aviation intrigues Dickie, and photography intrigues Dickie. Margaret Burke White becomes a model for Dickie, a role model.
Margaret Burke White made becoming a female war correspondent look easy. Other ambitious women reporters would find the path more complicated. January 1942, Martha Gellhorn was already an experienced journalist. She lived at the Finca, her home in the hills outside of Havana, Cuba, with Hemingway. Gellhorn grew up in St. Louis in a privileged home. Her mother was a suffragette and good friends with Eleanor Roosevelt. After college, she went to Paris to write and to see the world.
Martha was in a way a natural writer. When she began to write, I think she discovered in herself a longing to describe what can happen to people and how people survive bad things.
By 1936, when the Spanish Civil War broke out, Gellhorn had already published warnings of the danger of the rise of fascism in Europe. Among the nearly 35,000 people from 50 nations who went to Spain to fight fascism were many writers and journalists, including Hemingway. He and Gellhorn had recently met in Key West and fallen in love. He wrote Gellhorn to join him in Spain.
She wanted to go too, because she thought it sounded fun. And somebody said to her, you know, what are you doing? And she said, well, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm going where the boys are going.
Conventional war reporting, originally told from the soldier's perspective, had focused on the front line, the plans of generals, the battle and its outcome, and the arsenal of warfare.
You want to give your account of tactics, where you advanced, where you've had to fall back, how your strategies changed as you try to fight this particular battle. When it's over, you want to put it in some kind of perspective. You want to talk about strategical objectives, such as rivers or railroads or cities. That was the big picture kind of reporting.
Gellhorn had a different idea of the story of war.
Martha wanted to write not about how war is conducted, but about its effect on people.
An old woman with a shawl over her shoulders holding a terrified thin little boy by the hand runs out into the square. You know what she's thinking. She is thinking she must get the child home. You are always safer in your own place. She is in the middle of the square when the next one comes. A small piece of twisted steel, hot and very sharp, sprays off from the shell. It takes the little boy in the throat. The old woman stands there holding the hand of the dead child, looking at him stupidly, not saying anything.
I think what made her different, what makes her stand out, is that she started writing about the effects of war on ordinary people before it was seen to be the job of journalism. When she began in Spain writing these pieces about what war did to individual people, she was far ahead of our time.
We knew, we just knew that Spain was the place to stop fascism. This was it. It was one of those moments in history when there was no doubt.
She never got over it. She always felt that it was something that really should have been prevented, could have been prevented. And then, of course, it led to World War II.
When I started as a war correspondent, I thought that war was all about, you know, what we call in the business the bang bang, the shooting at the stuff that lights up the sky, but it's not. It's the disruption of lives. It's the aftermath, what we call the spillover. And as often as not, it leads to the next war. It's why it's so important to cover it, because you won't understand where the next war came from unless you understand the destruction of people's lives in the one that went before. Martha Gellhorn had it right. I think that is what war reporting is really all about.
For the next 3 years, that is what Gellhorn did. As Hitler's armies invaded countries across Europe, she continued to warn Americans about the threat of fascism in the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War. By 1942, she had traveled the globe covering war, sometimes with Hemingway at her side, and always with a letter from President Roosevelt granting her access to wherever she wanted to go. She was a featured reporter for Collier's Magazine. Back at home in Cuba, Martha Gellhorn's life was far removed from the destruction she had witnessed during her reporting, and a much-needed relief. Nevertheless, she listened intently to the news of the war on the radio.
Martha wanted to have the news on, and Hemingway didn't. because he didn't want to know, and Martha was increasingly saying, we need to get back to Europe and start writing about this.
But at the same time, she was ripped in two, because what was going through her head was, okay, you know, I've really got to make this marriage work. And maybe she still thought that they might have a child together. And he just felt, I want my hunting, my fishing, and to write novels.
With Hemingway's encouragement, Gellhorn wrote to her Collier's Magazine editor, Charles Colback, that she was ready for a war reporting assignment in Europe.
He said, ah, but you can't do it, because we can't send you to the front line, because there could be no women.
Now that the United States was officially at war, the American military would restrict Gellhorn because she was a woman, and despite being a seasoned war reporter.
Dear Charles, as you say, it is really too late to do anything about my sex. That is a handicap I have been struggling under since I was 5 years old, and I shall just forge ahead bravely, despite the army.
Women were not allowed anywhere near the battlefield. They were not allowed to cover press briefings at all. And the women who did so did it at the risk of losing accreditation, or being sent home, or even possibly being court-martialed.
There was a chauvinistic attitude that women would just break down at the site of combat, and they didn't want to be responsible for that, that covering war is not women's work, if you will. Another is that soldiers, if they were aware of the presence of a woman reporter in a combat zone, would go out of their way to protect her, perhaps at the expense of their own lives. And then the last one is women couldn't go into combat because there were no facilities for women. There were no toilets.
Eager to get her credentials as a war reporter, Dickie Chappelle met with U.S. Army press officer Colonel Ernest Dupuis.
Colonel Dupuis had only one question. I presume you realize, Mrs. Chappelle, that troops in the field have no facilities for women? I'd not only failed to realize it, I'd never even given it a minute's thought. Colonel, I said earnestly, I'm sure the 14th Infantry has solved much tougher problems than that, and they'll probably think of a way to lick this one, too.
2 months later, Chappelle was on an unarmed freighter headed to Panama for Look magazine. Suddenly, she spotted a submarine's periscope.
The waters, of course, in that region were mined by German submarines. And so she had hoped for this story of great, great action.
Her vision of a dramatic front-page news story disappeared underwater with the periscope. A week later, Chappelle was in Panama.
She's covering the Bushmasters, which is this elite team of jungle fighters. And they're training in Panama because the jungle is lush and thick and green. And the thinking is, if they can handle that, they can handle anything on some tropical island in the Pacific.
Chappelle took hundreds of photos, slogging with the troops through the mud and the heat of the jungle. She was photographing soldiers, but she was an ocean away from the war theater.
A war story out of Panama would not be much of a blood and guts story. The truth of the matter is, it's all training, it's not combat. She's in a backwater. There's really nothing there that's going to be as newsworthy as combat itself. So it's not a story.
From Panama, she repeatedly sent Look magazine her photos and stories. They chose not to publish them. Confined to the rear areas, she would never get the big story. And without a big story, she would get no interest from editors. While Chappelle was stuck in Panama, Margaret Burke White was in the news again. Burke White had the backing of a media giant and the reporter's knack of being in the right place at the right time.
Margaret Burke White gets her orders to go to North Africa, and she was originally supposed to go on a plane. Everyone flew. But the War Department said, no, we're not going to put women in a plane where they could get shot down. We're going to put them in a nice big boat. Boat that she's on gets torpedoed.
She got a much better story out of being in the boat that's torpedoed than if she'd gone on the press plane with the men.
Chappelle returned to the States a few months later. She had no torpedo story to tell and hundreds of unpublished photographs. Chappelle wrote to her Look magazine editor, Daniel Mitch.
If you all have been reading Margaret Burke White's publicity recently, you might like to know that Looks Girl Friday was in uniform before Margaret was.
January 1943 marked an unprecedented event in American history. The United States military was sending the first companies of Women's Army Corps overseas to a war zone. On board were two women war reporters, Inez Robb of the International News Service and Ruth Cowan of the Associated Press. Cowan's assignment was to report on the WACs, but she also hoped to witness and report on the action.
She's very excited to be with the WAC. She's covered their training. Of course, they don't know where they're going. It's a secret destination. She's been told to pack long underwear. So they know from the get-go it's going to be kind of tough going.
It turns out at the last minute, General Eisenhower wanted them in North Africa to take on clerical jobs and other work that would free men to go to the front.
By early 1943, the United States had taken its first steps militarily into the war, joining British troops to fight the Nazis in North Africa.
When Ruth Cowan arrives in North Africa, she considers herself to be a professional correspondent for the world's largest and most important news-gathering organization. She probably says to herself, I'm here, get me in the game, let me help.
Wes Gallagher was her new boss and the West Africa Bureau chief for the AP.
Gallagher takes one look at her and basically says, I want you out of here. I'm going to send you back immediately. We don't need to worry about protecting some woman. This is serious reporting. Wes Gallagher is a product of his time, where women belong in the home. He just believed that she was incapable of doing the job. To him, as it was to many people of his generation, a woman's place is certainly not in the battlefield. That's a man's place.
And he set it up so that she wouldn't have as much access to the kinds of stories that she wants to get as other reporters.
He shuns her, he won't talk to her. He forbids her from using the facilities to file stories. And meanwhile, she also has to fight the army, the American army, because the general says, one, you can't go into the canteen, so you can't eat with us. Two, you can't use any of our transportation. Other reporters would ride out in the jeeps and have the protection of the soldiers. You can't do that. So it was really an impossible situation to work.
With no institutional support, Cowan put her head down and focused on her assignment, churning out daily wire service reports.
As a war reporter, she was always looking for the woman's angle in everything that she wrote. Because of her wire service background, she's looking for things she can turn around fast. She's always looking for color. She was very conscious that families back home would be reading stories, and she would make a point of adding the names and hometowns of the different soldiers that she spoke with.
Weeks later, the Army agreed to Cowan's request to do a story on the nurses. They permitted her to go to an evacuation hospital in the Atlas Mountains in Tunisia, located safely well behind the front lines.
But sometimes the front is very fluid and it doesn't always stay where the Army wants it to stay.
In bitter fighting, Nazi tanks hurled back Allied forces to the Algerian border.
So all of a sudden, all these German tanks and planes start pushing against American lines. And when they break through, all hell breaks loose. Everyone starts retreating. And there's Ruth Cowan in this hospital. And all of a sudden, she has to get to the rear as fast as she can.
The Army is not providing transportation for Rob and for Ruth Cowan. The two of them find themselves without a ride on the road. I'm in the middle of the retreat, and they actually get pinned down under fire for about 20 minutes. They could have been killed.
She throws her gear away. She starts thumbing a ride. Someone finally picks her up and takes her back to where she would be safe.
Army censors would not permit Cowan to reveal the danger she had been in, nor report the news of the Allied defeat. Instead, she wrote,
we are now in a front lines hospital. All night long, nurses are getting up. Nurses who already had put in a day from 12 to 14 hours. Never in my life did I think women could live a life as hard as that of these nurses. But in their faces is calmness. The nurses in the operating room still wear white hose and shoes and aprons. They brought a good supply of cosmetics.
one of the most interesting paradoxes of Ruth Cowan's career was that she's doing this radical act. She's writing about war. She's breaking all of these cultural rules. So then when she files her story, she goes out of her way to sort of throw in all these gender stereotypes.
In Cowan's stories, women still seem to be women. Yes, they were wearing the government's uniforms. Yes, they were doing non-traditional jobs. But, and this is where we sigh a sigh of relief back home when we're reading this, they are women after all. And that's very reassuring to people.
And very popular, as Cowan would soon find out. Though not before she was disappointed to learn she was being transferred with the wax from the war zone in North Africa to London. There, a surprise awaited her, a letter from a US Navy commander. Ruth Cowan wrote a flock of hometown stories, just the right tales for mothers and relatives who want to know about those important facts of living, which most male reporters never see.
But for Cowan herself, it's kind of a trap, because there she is kind of doing what she thinks as a professional journalist as the trivia again. So now she's vindicated, her editors now love her stories, but she's got her own definition of what it means to be a war correspondent. And this isn't what she had in mind.
Even if you're restricted, you're there. And you're still witnessing history, and you're still interpreting it, and somebody's reading it, and you're expanding what people understand about war. You push the envelope.
She has this vision of what our wheel reporter should be. She doesn't get it that she's really stumbled onto something that's unique and wonderful.
I always used to ask myself when I would arrive somewhere, who would I be if this was happening where I live? Because what you always missed when you were reading about the war, any war, is what it was like for the people who have to live through it. And so I kind of made that my business. I felt that that was my responsibility.
November 1943, Martha Gellhorn arrived alone in London. Hemingway had encouraged her to go report the war without him. Gellhorn stayed at the Dorchester Hotel and met up with old friends, Virginia Cowles of the North Atlantic News Syndicate, and photographers Robert Capa and Lee Miller. Also congregating there were broadcaster Dorothy Thompson, Life magazine's Claire Booth Luce, Scripps Howard reporter Ernie Pyle, and Wire Service reporter Ruth Cowan.
The war reporters, they were mainly the Americans were in the Dorchester. They turned it into their sort of unofficial club. They're all waiting for the invasion. They're waiting for D-Day. And while they're waiting, they're having quite a good time.
And she arrived, first happy to see her colleagues, many of whom she hadn't seen since Spain. Remember, she's been isolated in Cuba for some time. So the initial few days of seeing people, of drinking, of camaraderie, seeing old lovers, seeing old friends. But eventually, it would have begun to drive her nuts, because she's not a group person.
To get her accreditation for Collier's magazine, Gellhorn had promised to abide by the restrictions on women reporters. No reporting from the front lines, no press briefings.
Martha had huge contempt always for press briefings. She felt them far more interesting than the individual battles were how the world was reacting. What was it like to be a country at war?
If women are excluded from one area, they oftentimes use this as almost an unwanted opportunity to look elsewhere for the story.
She visited a refugee camp outside of London.
In my village, the man said, people stood in front of the church and cried, is there a God? If there is, he would not allow these things to be. That was when the Germans came for the men and boys to send them away as slave labor. They also took the women they wanted. It was known that from these they would pick the girls to use in the brothels on the Eastern Front.
Gellhorn saw that the story of refugees is the story of war.
Gellhorn felt it was her responsibility to report on civilians. But she also believed in the professional imperative that a real war reporter is an eyewitness.
Martha got herself to Algiers, and from there to Italy, where she began to write about the beginnings of the Italian campaign.
These women war correspondents began to give American readers a taste of what the real war was like. And the real war is a war that affects civilians. It's civilians that are underneath the bombs. It is civilians that have to move from town to town. This, we have now understood today, is integral to understanding a war.
By this time, Gellhorn had been away from Cuba and Hemingway for 6 months. She wrote to him often, pleading with him to join her.
And Hemingway kept hounding her with letters. The Finca's falling apart, I need you here, putting this tremendous pressure on her.
She received a telegram from Hemingway. Are you a war correspondent or wife in my bed? Gellhorn flew back to Cuba to appease her furious husband.
He did something incredibly nasty. Hemingway could have had any magazine in the world. Anyone would have published what he wanted. He got Collier's to commission him to write about the war.
And since each magazine could only have one officially accredited reporter, Collier's chose Hemingway. Gellhorn lost her accreditation. Hemingway's Collier's assignment provided him with air transportation to Europe. He informed her that no women were allowed on the plane. She was forced to return to Europe on a freighter. The trip took 28 days.
She wrote from the boat a series of letters to various friends where she is actually mourning what is clearly the passing of their relationship. And when she arrived in London, Hemingway had already set himself up in the Dorchester, and down the corridor was war reporter Mary Welsh. And it was clear that he was having an affair with her.
...1944. Nearly 2 years after Pearl Harbor, the government's mobilization plan was in full force. Millions of men were overseas fighting, and millions of women were now working outside the home. This massive effort, intended only for the duration of the war, caused huge disruption in American society. A total transformation of the workforce at home. In every industry, jobs had opened up for women, from defense plants to newsrooms.
A lot of women all of a sudden had opportunities for things they never would have had before. It wasn't just the women's pages anymore. They could cover crime, they could cover government, and a select few could go cover war.
With 50% of the staffs of small city newspapers being female, it appeared that women reporters had finally made a breakthrough. Even military attitudes toward female war reporters seemed to have softened.
Correspondents in London received from AWAC a communique from which they will write their stories. For the New York Times, Sally Reston, and covering the news for Life and Time, Mary Welch. While Ruth Cowan's subject for the Associated Press is anti-aircraft defense, she's an example of how the American women correspondents are reporting the war.
The U.S. Army publicly promoted the women war reporters. But in London, Ruth Cowan was about to learn the military's actual stance.
In the weeks going up to D-Day, the women reporters were hoping they were going to get to go. They knew not in the first wave, but they thought they were going to be able to cover something in some way. In fact, Ruth Cowan had been lobbying the AP and expected the Army was going to let her accompany the first nurses. Well, 11th hour, the Army says, no, you can't go. And all women are banned from going over on D-Day.
Even Life magazine's media star, Margaret Burke White, was denied credentials. Instead, male reporters, including Walter Cronkite and Ernest Hemingway, were given prime spots. Male reporters reunited on the southern coast of England in preparation for D-Day. Ruth Cowan wrote a letter of protest to the president of the American Correspondents Association. It was co-signed by Martha Gellhorn and Mary Welsh.
I would like to submit a memo on the difficulties we women war correspondents are having, attempting to report on the activities of Americans at war. We are being stopped from doing a first-class workmanship job. Instead, we are forced into the position of wrangling and fighting to do our jobs. All I want is to do my job.
But for Martha Gellhorn, a letter of protest was not enough. She had too much at stake to abide by the restrictions.
So Martha goes down to the coast, to the docks, and she sees a large hospital ship with a Red Cross on it. So she walks up to the gangplank, and there is a military policeman who says to her, "What are you doing?" And she says, "I'm writing about the nurses for the woman's angle, for us all to know who the wonderful nurses are." So he, without thinking anything more, waves her on board.
So what she managed to do, which is just one of the great stories in journalism, is she hid in the bathroom of a hospital ship which was going to France. And so she left behind all of the accredited male reporters and got ahead of them.
And she lands with the nurses and doctors. And she helps bring up the wounded. And because she speaks some German and French, she then interprets for the doctors. And she files a fantastically good story about the landings and sends it to Collier's.
It will be hard to tell you of the wounded. There were so many of them. There was no time to talk. There was too much else to do. They had to be fed, as most of them had not eaten in 2 days. Shoes and clothing had to be cut off. They wanted water. The nurses and orderlies, working like demons, were called quickly to a bunk where a man suddenly and desperately needed attention. It seemed to take hours to pour hot coffee via the spout of a teapot into a mouth that just showed through bandages.
Hemingway, meanwhile, has not got ashore because his landing craft is not one of the ones that gets ashore. And he puts back to England and writes a piece for Collier's which says, "I got there, I saw everything."
Hemingway was so angry that she had managed to get ahead on the hospital ship. He did not see as much as she did, but ended up getting the splash front page story for Collier's.
Meanwhile, Ruth Cowan had waited dutifully behind. From the English shores, she stood witness to the poignant details of history as the first boats of wounded soldiers arrived.
"Bring up the ambulances," came a command. Litter bearers began placing them beside the gangplank. No one spoke. One shouted as he climbed into the truck, "We made it, after all."
When Martha got back from France, she was in big trouble with the military. She had no accreditation. And to punish her, they sent her off to where some nurses were training outside London in a sort of stately home. So she stuck it out a few days, and then she got out by rolling under the fence, and she went to an airport. So she got herself back into Europe. And from then on, she was never really accredited to any military group. She was never official again after that.
"I was a gypsy. No papers, nothing."
While Martha Gellhorn was flying back into Europe, a trend was emerging in the United States. newspaper editors began recognizing the value of women war correspondents, not just as reporters, but as news in themselves. They hired more women and advertised them as well.
So these women became sort of quasi-celebrities and were used in the marketing of the newspaper. It was considered kind of chic to have your girl war correspondent.
Dickie Chappelle realized it was the right time to push her editor to send her on assignment overseas.
I began by saying I wanted to cover what women were doing in the Pacific and anything else that happens while I'm out there. He didn't let me finish. We need somebody out there right now. Go ahead, just be sure you're the first woman reporter someplace.
A mighty invasion fleet heads for the most strategic goal thus far in the Pacific War, Iwo Jima, the island stronghold guarding Japan. Aboard the ship's direction...
February 1945. Chappelle found herself aboard the USS Samaritan, a hospital ship off the coast of Iwo Jima. Her baptism by fire began immediately.
Well, Dickie Chappelle is accredited to cover the use of whole blood in hospital situations, and she's not allowed to go ashore. And so her first encounter with war, the first time she sees war up close and personal, because she didn't get it in Panama, is when wounded Marines are coming in wholesale from the island. I mean, Iwo Jima is sheer butchery. Very quickly, this hospital ship, which is intended to take a few hundred, becomes just overloaded. It groans with the weight of the wounded and the dying.
It was just horrifying for her, and yet she was able to function. In many ways, I think perhaps the camera became the shield. She was going to be a professional who was looking through the lens, and whatever was on the other side of it, she was going to capture on film.
She takes one picture of a Marine who's bleeding profusely, and he's obviously in agony, but she doesn't think he's going to make it, so much so that in her notes for this photograph, she calls him, quote, dying Marine. Well, it turns out he's the perfect person for her to cover because he's given 14 units of whole blood. That's a lot. He must have been leaking like a sieve. But the blood brings him back. The next day, 24 hours later, he looks like he's a new man, and she decides to take his picture again. And side by side, you would swear these were two different people.
But Chappelle was determined to prove herself by becoming the first woman at the front lines in the Pacific War Theater.
In World War II, the front line still exists. There still is a line marking what area is under Allied control and what area is under Axis control. But for the first time, perhaps in warfare, it's not going to be a guarantee of where the action is, of where the real story is.
Dickie Chappelle wants to be where the GIs are. She defined the war zone really narrowly. She, in fact, was very traditional. She adopted exactly the male war correspondents and the generals and the editors' notion of where the war is. And the war is where you can feel the bullets whizzing by your head. Her notion of the war was at the front.
Her accreditation papers confined her to the ship, yet her editor wanted her to get ashore.
I wish I knew what was expected of me. Am I to take the feminine psychology and do as I've been told, to be the first woman somewhere? Which means I adopt the admired manly virtues and grab the first shoreward vessel I can? I have a fine incipient case of split personality, the masculine lined up against the feminine. This is no place for the feminine.
I actually think you can be very close. You can be in the middle of or on the front line, and it's not where it's happening. It's on the periphery sometimes that the most interesting moments occur.
Now on a hospital ship off the coast of Okinawa, she convinced a press officer it would be safe to photograph at a field hospital because the island looked so calm.
The Japanese that occupied the island allowed the American Army and Marines to just get safely on shore and get into the interior. And it wasn't until everybody was on shore that they came out of their caves and their holes and they started to launch a counterattack.
She's traveling around the island. She's not supposed to be there, of course. And she finally gets to one of the very forward hospitals. And the doctor there is just appalled to see her. What the hell are you doing here? And she realizes she's just incredibly unwelcome. In the middle of the night, a crew brings in four injured soldiers. One needs some serious surgery. And Dickie holds a flashlight for several hours while the surgeon performs surgery on this young soldier. As she's holding the flashlight, Dickie is very, very much a part of the war. She is no longer the spectator with the camera recording. She's in it.
A pool of blood, clenched fist. That wasn't war. None of those Hollywood trademarks of horror were valid here. Everybody out here had seen some guy trailing his innards. That was the real story of war.
Grateful to Chappelle for her help, the surgeon allowed her to photograph the wounded.
But she's there in violation of the orders. The Navy had no intention of letting any female war correspondent spend the night on the island with the troops, and she was escorted out. The magazine that hired her for this assignment, Life Story, refuses to run her pictures.
My editor said, "Dickie, of course, our readers are interested in knowing that their injured men are cared for, but you should have known better than to have made these pictures. We can't use them. The wounded look too dirty."
Editors and publishers and advertisers and the government didn't necessarily want to hear about how severe the wounds were. They didn't want to hear about the real horrors of war. Almost none of us really have the stomach for that.
When the bang bang is over, what is left is this destruction of a country, of a place, of a people. The actual war itself is a small part of what's happening. The legacy of women war reporters in World War II was to start to show us the collateral damage of war, the social damage of war, and that is the lasting aspect of war.
May 1945. The war in Europe was coming to an end. Martha Gellhorn had been traveling across the European front since D-Day, operating completely on her own, with no papers or protection from the U.S. military.
She had tremendous fortitude and strength, really, because it's physically exhausting to report a war. And she kept going for months and months and months.
She wrote a letter to her editor at Collier's.
"Today I saw pictures of two bodies dug up from some boneyard in Toulouse. They had been tortured by Gestapo until they died. I look at anything you see because I do not admit one can turn away. One has no right to ignorance. One has no right to spare oneself. But I have never before seen faces with gouged out eyes. I thought I had seen it all, but evidently not."
He decided to publish her letter as an article and asked her to keep going.
In the early spring of 1945, more and more refugees were beginning to cross with the advancing Allied troops. Martha just heard more and more stories about these camps all over occupied Europe, which were said to be full of people who'd been used as slave labor and there'd been extermination camps. Nobody knew too much about any of it. Mm.
She arrived in Dachau soon after its liberation by the Allied forces.
I think she felt this tremendous sense of personal responsibility because this had started as far back as Spain and had not been stopped.
She said the spectacle, what she saw and what she realized men had done to other men, was so appalling to her that it entered her soul and that she never again was free of it.
Gellhorn was in the infirmary at Dachau when a doctor told her that the war in Europe had come to an end. All over Europe, people celebrated the Allied victory.
We are not entirely guiltless, we the Allies, because it took us 12 years to open the gates of Dachau. We were blind and unbelieving and slow. And that we can never be again. If ever again we tolerate such cruelty, we have no right to peace.
3 months later, the United States dropped an atom bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 150,000 Japanese civilians were killed. The Japanese surrendered. World War II had finally come to an end. In all, 24.5 million military personnel had been killed. And over 40 million civilians. The three women, having pushed themselves and the boundaries of the war story, found a surprise back home.
A lot of the women who covered World War II found after the war that there was a big call for women to retreat to the home. Big call in the media, okay, the war is over, you performed men's jobs splendidly, but that was only temporary.
In journalism, editors roll back the gender changes that have taken place in wartime, and they oftentimes do it quite crudely. I mean, they will take a very skilled woman journalist and put her back on the woman's page. All in the name of recreating this mythical notion of the normal society.
Ruth Cowan, weeks before the war ended in Europe, she was taking Nembutal, she was taking Sikonol, she was drinking a lot of alcohol. They told her, listen, go take a vacation in the States, you can come back to Europe. So she goes home, and she had a nervous breakdown.
After recovering, she returned to an assignment at the Pentagon.
A few years later, somebody discovers that they don't have enough women's stories coming out of Washington. And so they send her from the Pentagon over to cover the White House and the women's angle of Washington. So she goes from covering bombers to things like Ike's favorite barbecue recipe.
2 weeks after her 55th birthday, the mandatory retirement age for women at the Associated Press, Cowan married for the first time and moved with her husband to a farm in West Virginia. She finally got the recognition she deserved as the president of the Women's National Press Club and as an advisor on women in the services for the Defense Department. As she had in the past, Martha Gellhorn retreated into writing her novels. But this time, she did something else extraordinary.
She adopted a child. An Italian war orphan, Alessandro, who she called Sandy. This was a little boy who had been orphaned during the war, and she adopted him, and she tried to build a life for the two of them.
She would continue to report wars into the 1980s. Her career spanned 6 decades, the longest career of any American war reporter. Although Dickie Chappelle had been sent home in disgrace, her photographs of the dying Marine were being used in a Red Cross poster. She now knew she could cover wars. She did so for the next 25 years. She became the photographer editors told their reporters to follow into a war zone, because she would always find the story. She won the George Polk Award for the best reporting in any medium, requiring exceptional courage and enterprise.
I think as a body of work, it says you need to be close. You need to be up there, close to where it's happening, to really tell the story of war, to have people understand what war is really all about. And in 1965, she was assigned to go to Vietnam. It was there that she was killed by a landmine on an operation with the US Marines.
At 46 years old, Chappelle was the first American woman journalist to be killed while on assignment. The Marine Corps gives an award in her honor every year.
It is not a woman's place. There's no question about it. There's only one other species on Earth for whom a war zone is no place, and that's men. But as long as men continue to fight wars, why, I think observers of both sexes will be sent out to see what happens.
I'm Joyce Lau. I work for the New York Times. I guess the obvious question, since Claire Hollingworth, she just left, she's 102, she broke the story of the Nazi invasion of Poland on the Polish border in 1939. Just wondering, your film doesn't address any non-American correspondents, and the Brits and the Europeans were in 2 years before the Americans, and there were certainly women amongst other countries' foreign correspondence corps. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
It's right here. So the question is, why am I focusing on American women exclusively?
Well, yes, so the film is about women.
So war correspondence. It was made for public broadcasting, American Public Broadcasting, and was funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities, so the focus was exclusively on American women.
Francis?
Francis Moriarty, freelance. Anybody who knows anything about Hemingway knows that while he was a wonderful writer, he could be a real creep, which I think is made clear. But it seems to me that there was also, and I raise this because it relates to this area as well as to the individuals Gellhorn and Hemingway. It seems to me that they actually came up to China together to cover part of the Chinese Civil War. Could you talk about that a little bit?
What would you like to know? She had the assignment. And she actually writes about that quite humorously in Travels with Myself and Another. And she only refers to him as UC, which is unwilling companion, because he didn't want to be there. And I got a grant from the Hemingway Foundation, which allowed me to read their correspondence, which I was really happy that I was able to do, because I have to say I went in with a vision of Hemingway, of this sexist bore, and I was actually pleasantly surprised when I read his correspondence to her that he actually wasn't that. I had a very different impression from his letters of somebody who was actually much more modern in his thinking. And he repeatedly said, the most important thing to me is that you're happy. And if you want to report wars, I encourage you to do that. I want you to do that. And I will take care of the finca. The kids were his kids from his previous wife, Pauline. And so the letters are, I'm taking care of the finca. The kids are coming. Don't you worry about it. I'm going to be taking care of them. And the article that I refer to in Travels with Myself and Another, you really see from her perspective how much they enjoyed each other. And that's something also that was really another thing that was eye-opening about their relationship. So, I believe it or not, I did bend over backwards to try to show that he was encouraging her. When he turned on her, he was very nasty. But in this article, you can see what a great relationship that they had together and how much fun he would have been to be with, what a character he was, how interesting he was, how funny he was, and that she really, really enjoyed him and their time together. But as I said, when he turned on her, he really turned on her.
Hi, Mary McHale, and really enjoyed your film. It was brilliant. Thank you. Just a question. Have you done any follow-up interviews with modern-day female journalists, American or otherwise? Because I think in specifics to American television and even CNN, while I see the women on CNN being able to report the hard stories, I sometimes question what they're being asked to wear when they're reporting those hard stories.
That's a great question, and I had actually hoped that I would get funding to do exactly that. I interviewed a number of people, telephone interviews and things like that, for background for this, and then interviewed the women that you see here, the contemporary reporters. And when I was doing that, I was hoping that I could then continue and create an archive and have a real resource of women war correspondents and what they're doing now. But unfortunately, the funding for that did not come through. I have some promises of funding because I think it is a good project and other people do as well, but I haven't had the funding for that. I would love to do that.
Thank you.
If you had anybody that you could encourage to provide funding, I would love to continue interviewing these women.
Hi, my name is Emily Tan. Back to Gellhorn and Hemingway. Do you have any idea why he did turn against her eventually? Was it jealousy that she was getting all the attention?
I think when you read his letters, you know, as I said, he was very happy for her to go. But you get the sense that he started to get lonely, and you know, so he's starting to ask, you know, okay, I'm glad you're there, and then, you know, the next few letters, okay, I'm here by myself. Okay, I'm here by myself, and when are you coming back? And then finally, you know, the telegram, are you a war correspondent, wife in my bed? So you really see this arc of him getting angrier and I think getting lonely that she's not there with him. And as Carolyn Moorhead, the biographer for Martha Gellhorn, says, he really did not want to continue. He didn't want to be reporting war. That was really her gig. That's what she wanted to be doing. And he felt that he had done that, that part of his life was over, and he wanted to concentrate on his novels. And in fact, that's something she wanted to do, and I think that was part of the allure of their relationship initially, that she would be writing novels with him. But there was just something in her, the need to bear witness, and she just couldn't sit by and, you know, in Cuba and listen to the war on the radio.
Really enjoyed all the visual that came along with the story. How did you go about to find the right footage to match the stories of the ladies? Because, you know, I mean, were they archived being relation to their immediate locations? And, you know, that sort of how you were able to match that, because it does help with the story, but it's always an interesting, you know, sort of part.
So that's sort of a multi, that's a question that has multiple or multi-pronged answer. The first of all, I work with one of the best archivists. He's amazing. So he was able to really pull from a variety of archive sources. I also had, you know, part of my proposal to the National Endowment was that there was a lot of archive that had never been seen because it related to women, and so we were able to use that kind of footage. At the same time, I had to also choose to focus on women where there was some documentary record. And because Gellhorn was with Hemingway, and you know, Robert Capa, Lee Miller, you know, were their good friends, there were a lot of photographs of the two of them, and he was sort of, he was a star in his time, so there was archival footage and things like that. That one clip where he's with her at the beginning is from Hedda Hopper's Hollywood. So, you know, he was of, you know, that sort of echelon where people were interested in him. You know, I mean, that's almost everybody now can be on TV and have that kind of thing. But you had to be a real star in the true sense of the word to have the amount of stuff that was footage and photographs and things like that. Ironically, the photographer, Dickie Chappelle, had the least amount of photographs. So that was very disappointing. And then Ruth Cowan was sort of the gift that kept on giving. We found, you know, sort of at the 11th hour, we found that that newsreel of women war correspondents, and then lo and behold, there she was. Because she was, you know, a very important wire service reporter, but she'd also been in this newsreel. But having said that, there was a lot of great archive, but in order to portray our main characters, their words were so moving. And I would have been hiring actors anyway to voice their words, but I didn't want to just have sort of an artful, horizon of water, candles or something like that. So I chose to portray them doing these, monologues, stand-up monologues, to really bring them to life. So, so it was really pulling in a variety of resources in order to tell this story. And it was, it was very rich. I was able to use a lot of different resources.
Hi, thank you. Susan Madden, University of Southern California. I thought it was wonderful. Thank you very much. I had a question. I know how difficult it is to get a grant from the
National Endowment for the Humanities.
Or any government grant. But could you talk a little bit about the timeline, the process of the documentary process itself, how long it took for you to get this?
Sure. I applied for funding for the National Endowment for the Humanities for the first time in 2001. And that was just a grant. It's a seed grant, which they actually don't provide anymore, which is unfortunate because it's actually a really great grant to be able to pay to bring the scholars together to discuss the viability of the project. And I was able to get that grant, which is unheard of, the first time out. So I wrote a grant, they accepted it, I got the money, and the National Endowment was behind the project from the get-go, and they were incredibly supportive, both in words and money. So the funding, I had to go through about four stages of funding, and as painful as it seemed at the time, it was really, it's actually an excellent process because it's so demanding that you have to know exactly what it is that you're looking at, what you're looking for, who you're going to be talking to. I had a great team of scholars that I pulled together. It was an absolute pleasure to be working with them. And then once I had gone through this sort of four levels, which that was from 2001 to 2008. I had to do a trailer at that point, and that's when I got the big funding, which was $750,000, which was almost enough to make the film, and I still had to do other fundraising for it. So a lot of times when people were asking me through this process, what is it you're doing? I had to say I'm fundraising. I'd love to say I'm a filmmaker, but I'm fundraising. And so the research was a couple of years, but the fundraising was the thing that took the longest. And then once we had the money, the actual workflow to make the film from production to post-production was about 14 months. And then it doesn't end there, because then it goes into I had to find a distributor. And luckily, Women Make Movies was my fiscal sponsor through the process, which doesn't necessarily guarantee that they're going to be your distributor. But they loved the film and they wanted to distribute it. So I had them on my team right away. And so it's gone out to festivals. And they, got PBS to be the, which again is also not a slam dunk. PBS, even though it was made for PBS, they don't necessarily say, of course, we'll take it. Which I actually naively thought at the beginning of the process was the case, that they would take it. But they did wind up buying it. And then Women Make Movies is a huge educational distributor. So it's actually doing really well in educational distribution.
Hi, I'm Patty from Hong Kong. I really enjoyed the do. It's like a double whammy. Got a nice dinner and a movie. I wish I had invited more people in. But one of the things, I'm always controversial. So I was wondering, because in your film, you sort of interviewed the person, and then you have a few female correspondents and maybe one academic who is a man. So it's always nice to see. I can't believe that all the men agree with all that. So it would be nice to see some men brave enough to be on camera to say that they don't agree with it. So is it by design that you don't you have not included an interview of all the correspondents at that time who is a male?
Sorry, I guess I'm still not understanding the question. Why didn't I have any male correspondence from the period?
We're talking about why he had to, but being against him.
The person that I would point to in that was Wade Gallagher, Wes Gallagher, who was the bureau chief, who I think sort of exemplified what the male attitude was at that point in time in terms of not wanting to have women there. But having said that, there were also generals that were actually perfectly okay with women in the war zone. So, and again, there's always the constraints of time. I would have loved to have included a number of other stories, one of them being a discussion that Ruth Cowan had with Patton, who had absolutely no problem with her and was actually very supportive of her, where her editor, Wes Gallagher, was not. So I don't think it was necessarily just exclusively that the men didn't want them there, but that was the predominant attitude.
Just a comment more than anything else. There were women, one of whom happens to be a personal acquaintance of mine, she's now passed on, who covered the war on the Eastern Front, not on the Western Front. And they were usually people who were sympathetic to the communist side of things, or the Soviet side as it was then. But there were women correspondents usually writing for things like the Daily Worker or whatever. Now, there may have been some others who were working for more standard publications. But they're just to say that there was on the other side of the fence, on the other side of the incoming troops headed for Germany, some women who did report.
What's my next project? I'm actually fundraising again for another project. I was in India a number of years ago on a journalism fellowship, and the team that I worked with there, and I've been trying to work together again. Of course, my cameraman now lives in New Jersey, but the main person, co-producer that I'm working with, still lives in Ahmedabad. And we're working on a documentary looking at the issue of sanitation, and we're doing it from one person's perspective, so it's a very personal look at a huge issue which affects, well, obviously the entire world, but 2.5 billion people worldwide who don't have access to quote unquote proper sanitation. So it's called Nowhere to Go, and it looks at the woman, a woman who's physically challenged in rural Gujarat, who, despite all the odds, put a latrine in her home and is now trying to convince other people in her village to do likewise.
Well, I think if there's no more questions, then Michelle, thank you very much. And on behalf of FCC, we have a little gift for you.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, thanks very much, everybody. Thank you.
Thought it was chocolate when I first looked at it. I was like, oh, they produce their own chocolate.